Some years ago, there was a member of this community named Gene Hawkins. Gene was a very, very faithful member of this community. She always seemed to me like an old lady. When I first came here, she's probably the age I am now. And I know to many people, now I seem like an old man. But Gene was, I forget, does anybody remember when Gene died? I can't remember. I went and looked in all the records we still have in our office, and I couldn't find any reference to her service. But it's got to be, so it must be over 10 years ago. But Gene was incredibly smart. She spent her life, I think, raising a family, and the rest of her life she spent studying the Bible. Gene knew the Bible amazingly well. She was incredibly well-versed in Scripture. She frequently put me to shame with her biblical knowledge. But Jean and I had a running debate. Some people might have called it an argument, but you'd never argue with Jean. That would be silly. And she was much too sweet to argue with me. But we had a disagreement. And our disagreement, the disagreement Gene and I had, which seemed to come up all the time, was about the nature of human history. I know you all argue about that all the time, right? Because Gene had one view, and I had a different view. The two views, one viewed human history as this kind of desperate deterioration, a downward spiral into pain and anguish and suffering and injustice. This view saw human history as just getting worse and worse and worse every day and year after year. The other view was slightly more optimistic and saw human history as a kind of repeating cycle, that terrible things happen, terrible things happened, and then good things happen. There is a cycle of death and pain and destruction, and then a cycle of new life and hope and resurrection. Now, if you had to guess, I wonder which side of that argument you would have put me on. Well, you'd probably all be wrong. I, turns out, was the chipper optimist in the argument. Gene was determined that human history was going down the tube. And she had tons of evidence. Every time something horrible happened, she'd show up and come to me with glee and say, look, see, it proves. Look how bad it is. It's getting worse all the time. Nothing this bad has ever happened before. It's worse and worse and worse. And then I'd say, yeah, but I have a granddaughter. Look at that. How could things be getting worse when beautiful new life is coming into the world? Or I would show some example of some kind of lovely occurrence of kindness or generosity out there in the world, and she'd grumble. Well, I think that the prophet Habakkuk was probably on my side of the argument. Because 2,500 years ago, when Habakkuk, the prophet, the minor prophet, looked out at the world around him, he had an incredibly dark vision of the nature of human affairs. He describes what he sees, saying that he sees, when he looks out at the world, he sees violence. Well, that sounds really new, doesn't it? He sees wrongdoing. He looks out at the world and he sees terrible trouble all around him. He sees destruction and then more violence. He sees strife and contention. He looks out at the world and he sees that the law, he says, has become slack. He sees that justice never prevails. He sees that the wicked surround the righteous, and judgment comes forth perverted. And then in the reading, as Michael read it this morning, as it's assigned by the lectionary, we skip a few verses and we go on to his response. But just to make sure that you don't think we're hiding anything, the verses that we didn't read are just as gloomy and just as dark and just as depressing as the verses that we did read. A world of violence, a world of wrongdoing, trouble, destruction, strife, contention, slack law, justice that doesn't prevail, wickedness that surrounds righteousness, and judgment that is perverted. That was 2,500 years ago. I think, in my most optimistic spirit, that sounds fairly familiar to me. There's always been difficulty. There's always been pain. There's always been struggle in this life and in this world. Jesus said, it's funny, you know, we always end our gospel reading saying, this is the gospel of Christ, the good news of Christ. And so when we read John 16:33, we end by saying, this is the gospel of Christ, the good news of Christ. And Jesus says, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. This is the gospel of Christ. Yay! The word translated as trouble is thlipsis. The Greek word is thlipsis. Some places it's translated as persecution, which is my least favorite persecution, my least favorite translation, because it suggests something that most of us probably won't really experience. But we will experience trouble. We will experience thlipsis. Thlipsis is friction. It's pain. It's turmoil. It's unrest. Strife, it's disharmony. It's all the stuff that the prophet Habakkuk was speaking about. And in fact, it turns out it's the stuff that Jesus' disciples were afraid of. Our gospel reading this morning started out with this question. The apostles said to the Lord, this request, the apostles said to the Lord, increase our faith. So that's Luke 17, verse 5. And you know, scholars are funny people. They look at that verse and they say, where did that request come from? What are they asking that for? Seems like a non sequitur. In fact, I read one scholar this week commenting on these verses who said he felt like the gospel writer Luke had a bunch of post-it notes with sayings of Jesus written on them. They're all over his desk, and he's organizing them into themes. And then he gets all done. He thinks he's finished, and he suddenly looks over and he goes, oh, no! And he sees a little stack of post-it notes that he hasn't filed yet under theme. And he has to figure out where they go. And so, according to this scholar, he just stuck them all in Luke 17, 1 to 10. And in fact, if you look in your pew Bibles, I think you'll see that the title that is given, have you got that? Is it there? What's the title?
Some Sayings of Jesus.
Some Sayings of Jesus. Well, that's okay. Put all my post-it notes in there. Some Sayings of Jesus. I don't know why they're together. I don't know what the point is, but that's where we'll stick them for now. It's sort of your pending file. But I actually think there is a direct connection between Luke 17, verses 1 to 4, and the request that Jesus' disciples make in Luke chapter 17, verse 5. Because in Luke chapter 17, verse 1, Jesus says to his disciples, occasions for stumbling are bound to come, but woe to anyone by whom they come. And then he goes on to give a picture of pain and suffering that is going to come into their lives when they stumble. I think Jesus' disciples are afraid. They're afraid of the world they see around them. They're afraid of the world that Habakkuk portrays in chapter 1, a world they see of violence, a world they see of wrongdoing and trouble and destruction and strife and contention. It's a world they don't want to face. And so they understand that they can't fix it, they can't change it, they can't make it all right. They understand that the important question is not, how do I change this situation? The important question is, how do I respond to the realities that I see around me? And their answer, and the answer that Habakkuk, the prophet, gives, is the same. I choose to respond with faith. Lord, increase our faith. And the prophet Habakkuk ends our reading this morning saying, their spirit is not right in them, but the righteous live by their faith. So what does faith look like? I see two things in the prophet Habakkuk that describe, I think, the nature of faith, and one thing in Jesus' odd story that he tells in response to his disciples, this curious little story about a slave serving his master. Habakkuk says two things about faith. First thing he says is, I will stand at my watch post. Faith is the willingness, the ability, just to stand. Just to stand there. Stand your ground. There is something within us that is not shaken by the violence, the horror, the pain, and the suffering of life. So it really doesn't matter whether Gene Hawkins was right or I was right. What matters is that in the face of the realities of the life that we see around us, we are able to find within ourselves that place that can simply stand unshaken. And I think that's one of the reasons why we, those of us who do, come here. And I think it's one of the reasons why we try not to change absolutely everything every Sunday. We come here because we want to be in touch with that timeless, steady reality that resides within our hearts. And hearing the same words, hearing the same language, hearing the same voice over and over helps to connect us with that steady reality. I can't remember, it was one of the young people 2 years ago, back when we started talking about the R word around here, and that's retirement, the R word. And she came to me and she said, what will I do if I go to church and I don't hear the sound of your voice? I thought, wow, what a strange thing to say. But I've thought about that a lot since. And I just think, you know, there's something about the familiarity and the steadiness of hearing the same timbre, the same intonations, the same reflections, that same kind of cadence over and over again, the same kind of language. You might think it's boring, but it's not just boring. It's steady and reliable. And it signals to us something important about ourselves, that we carry within us that spirit of steadiness and faithfulness that can just stand its ground. So that's the first thing about faith. It stands its ground. But the second thing that the prophet says about the nature of faith, he says, I will stand at my watch post and station myself on the rampart. I will keep watch to see. I love that. It's important to be willing to see honestly what is going on in our lives and in the world around us. I think I told you maybe a couple of weeks ago about this massive biography of Albert Speer that I've been reading. Albert Speer was Hitler's architect. And Albert Speer was sentenced to 20 years in prison after the war, and then he wrote two big books that made him rich and famous. And but he was interviewed by Gita Sareny, and for this huge book, and she quotes him all the way through, and they had many hours and hours and hours of conversation. And she would bring up this some kind of horror, some terrible thing that happened during the war, and he would say over and over again, "Oh, but I didn't see that. I didn't see that. No, I didn't see that." And then finally, there's one point, one moment, where she brings up another horror. And he says, "Oh, I didn't see that." And then it's almost as if you can see him pause. And he says, "You know, we just didn't see what we didn't want to see." That's not an option for people of faith. People of faith are not at liberty to choose not to see the realities of their lives. And we can afford to see clearly and honestly because we can stand. We can afford to see honestly and realistically the struggles and difficulties of life around us and of our own lives and of our families and of family because we know that we can stand our ground. We can know that there is that within us which is not constantly knocked off balance. That there is within us a steady, strong, secure, abiding reality that holds and that is not shaken. So faith stands and faith pays attention. And the third thing is from this funny little story that Jesus tells about a slave who's come in from plowing, tending the sheep in the field, and his master says, "Come and make my dinner." And the slave doesn't expect to be fed first. And then Jesus ends by making the point, saying in the NRSV translation, which you just got annoying and argue with, "We are worthless slaves. We have done only what we ought to have done." Better translation than worthless is unprofitable, undeserving. We don't deserve to have a meal laid for us before we have done what needs to be done. And that's the third thing about faith. Faith just does the next thing that needs doing. It's not fancy. It's not elaborate. It's not glamorous. Faith stands in the face of whatever's going on, looks clearly, and then does the next thing it knows to do. That's all. Faith is not overwhelmed by the horrors and the pain and the suffering and the difficulties and the struggles of life, because faith knows that having stood its ground, having looked clearly, it will then know what is the next thing that needs to be done. You can trust that. You can count on that. You cannot count on knowing the future. You cannot count on controlling the future. You cannot count on always being able to make things go the way you want to go them to go. But you can count on when you get there, if you've stood your ground, if you've looked clearly, you can then rely upon the wisdom and the insight and the strength and the truth and the understanding that resides within you, and it will guide you to what is the next thing that you need in your life to do. What ought to be done? The next thing. The next logical thing that is guided by the Spirit that resides within us does become clear to the eyes of faith that have stood their ground, that have seen clearly the realities of what is going on in the world around us and in their own lives, has taken it all into consideration, and then has made the next logical step forward. So we don't need to be paralyzed by fear. We don't need to have an increase of faith. Jesus was right. Faith as small as a mustard seed knows. I can have mustard seed sized faith. It's really little. It's really tiny. It looks terribly insignificant on the surface. But it is the deep knowing of the rightness of life and the guidance of God's Spirit walking forward with us as we move one step in front of the next. Amen.